She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Tight and Giant Lasers. I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn, a writer and a fan of Visionaries, Knights for Magical Light.
And I'm Miles Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer and a fan of the hologram Arnold Judas Rimmer, one of the greatest written characters in all of sci-fi TV.
Wow. A bold claim that I feel is almost penned by Arnold Judas Rimmer himself. Each episode, we watch stories from three different Star Trek shows and we rank them on a big list of best to worst. We both love Star Trek, but as it's far from our first fandom, it makes us the ultimate objective voices on such a task. And this episode, we're going to be having a look at the most faulty part of any spaceship and space station. Somehow, one of the most dangerous things, and they keep putting them in there. Yes, it's the holodeck. But before we go on, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Well, last Monday, I went to see a movie, and it's not a new movie. It's a re-release of an old movie, one of my guilty pleasure films. And you know that there is a Dune Part 2 coming out in the next week?
Yes.
And, of course, a few years ago, there was a Dune Part 1.
Normally, those happen before the Part 2s.
Yeah. And then in the 80s, there was a film directed by David Lynch of the book Dune. Now, Charlie, have you ever seen this cinematic experience?
I have seen it multiple times.
So, it's honestly one of my kind of guilty pleasure movies. And when I found out it was going to get a re-release for 2 days to coincide with Part 2 of Dune, I got a friend of mine who we've been having a 20-year friendship based over his hatred of the David Lynch Dune film and my love of the David Lynch Dune films.
So you decided to torture this friend by dragging him along to the big screen Dune. Or did you give him, like, a fiver to go to the arcade while you went and saw Dune?
No, I dragged him.
Wow.
And a great time was had by all. Because honestly, sometimes, you know, when you watch, like, older films, that's on, like, a TV or, you know, you forget that these films are meant to be seen on the big screen. And while as an adaptation, this film is not great. As a visual movie experience, there is something incredibly unique about Dune. For a post-Star Wars, for a film made clearly to capitalize on the popularity of Star Wars, no other science fiction film has looked like this, or will ever look like this again.
As much as I liked the villain of Dune Part 1, there are visuals from Lynch's Dune which stick with me to this day, even though the last time I saw it was, I don't know, at least 15 years ago. I will be rewatching it at some point soon with all the Dune hype going on. But yeah, it's something where it's so unique and weird.
Yeah, and like, it's that unique weirdness which makes the Villeneuve Dune, which looks good in its own way, it just looks bland. It's just, there's no kind of energy to it.
It's got an interesting look, but yeah, it feels a bit more static than the Lynch Dune. And, you know, not as entertaining. Well, I don't know, I was about to defend the TV movie, like, Siffy Dune, which is bad, quite bad.
Look, here is what I have to say about the Syfy Dune.
Mm-hmm.
We have made no secret of my love of Doctor Who.
Yeah. And
Doctor Who's ability to make galactic empires out of 10 pounds and some string. Yes, oh, I was
definitely.
Was editing that episode a few hours before recording.
Oh dear God.
But when I say that the Dune sci-fi TV series looks cheap, and I mean that in a negative way, I feel like that speaks for itself. It makes Babylon 5 look like The Expanse in the production value stake.
Wow. Wow. That is the nerdiest burn.
Nerd burn.
Yeah. Good. So yeah, it sounds like it was a fun time.
A fun time was had by all, apart from Sting, who it's quite a surprise that his attempt to emulate David Bowie and get a popular movie career never took off. And I think it's like this, a cameo in The Simpsons, and that might be it.
Oh, no, he was in Only Murders in the Building briefly.
Oh, God, yeah. How could I forget? Okay, how could I forget that fantastic cameo? Clearly, Sting's best role is comedic versions of Sting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But he's still going to be more distinctive as in that thong, that leather thong thingy in Dune than the creepy albino child who I think is meant to be Fade Ruffer. That we've seen in the trailers.
They've definitely gone for a look with the Harkonnens.
They have. But they still kept the fat as evil, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But this is not a Frank Herbert Has Issues podcast, because, God, we would be here all day. And, Charlie, what is your thing?
My thing is an adorable game that I've played on the Switch, and not just that, but completed and 100%ed on the Switch, because it's not a long game. It's called Little Gator, and it's where you play a little alligator who's a hyperactive kid. He runs around, arms flailing, and really wants to have a fun time in a playground, and his big sister is too busy with her college work. And he decides that he's going to get all his friends. He's going to pretend like it's a fantasy world. He drags them into making cardboard standees of monsters, spreading them all around this island, and runs around doing missions for all the different kids there, trying to encourage them to join the playground that he's in and make it up like a fantasy town. And any of the monsters you hit, they are literally cardboard standees. So it's not like anything fights back, but there's a lot of imagination going on from the gator himself and from everyone around. So it's extremely heartwarming, extremely lovely. And just running around, being an annoying little brother, smashing everything and crashing into the places. It's very good fun. And yeah, it mustn't have taken me all that many hours to do. In the end.
See, when you say like little alligator with flailing arms, I can't help but think of Fuecoco from the recent Pokemon game.
Yeah, yeah, there's definitely an amount of Fuecoco energy. Yeah, that kind of, I don't know, like imagine that, but as mixed with, say, maybe a 6-year-old child. Very hyper, collecting confetti and trying to use it as payment for things. And yeah, just running around the place. There's a lot of Zelda in it. There's a stamina bar that you increase by finding the bracelet master, who gives you bracelets, which basically stamina wheels to help you climb things. And yeah, you get equipment like maybe a paintbrush or like some origami stars to throw at things. It's, yeah. Heartwarming.
This sounds incredibly charming.
Yes. Yes, our first episode of the evening is Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1, Episode 12, titled The Big Goodbye. It aired on the 11th of January, 1988, written by Tracy Torme and directed by Joseph L. Scanlon. The UK number one hit was Pet Shop Boys, Always on My Mind, and the US one was Whitney Houston with So Emotional. I realize I know so few Whitney Houston tracks.
And we get a double dose of Whitney this week.
Yeah, yeah. We get a double Houston. And neither of which I ever remember having heard before.
No.
No, it's, yeah. Like, Always on My Mind is something that feels like it's existed after this week in 1988.
See, the only thing I keep, did you ever used to see the show Dead Ringers?
No.
Okay. It was an impression show. One of the kind of recurring skits was one of the actors could do a very good Tom Baker. So they did Doctor Who related sketches a lot. And one was a parody of Living with the Enemy, where the Doctor has to live with the Cybermen family. And there's a point when they're singing this song drunkenly at karaoke.
Wow.
So that's whenever I hear this song, snap, that's where I am.
Okay. Yeah, I remember listening to Dead Ringers, the radio show, and not caring for it. So I never really...
It's one of those sketch shows which, you know, which you kind of get a lot, I feel like, in the 90s and 2000s. Once you've seen each sketch, like, three times, you've seen the entire show because they basically, it's the same gag.
Yeah, I'm recapping this one, so I need to get my my suit, my fedora, not a milady fedora, but private detective fedora on, and yeah.
Okay, I will try and set you up as best I can.
Okay.
It was cold in the city of San Francisco as Charlie Etheridge Nunn walked into the office, drew on his pipe, drew on the walls, and drew on the light bulb. My God, that man could draw on anything. And then a shot rang out, saying, "This is your landlord. You've got 5 minutes to recount the plot of this episode, you big galoot." Like so. Engage.
So... Wow, the Enterprise is meeting the Haradans, a very fussy group of insects who require Picard to get the language just right in order to deal with them. He jokes about spelling knife with an N, but he's really stressing out a bit. Troy suggests have some time off in the holodeck, and he knows just where to go. Two words, Dixon Hill. And yeah, it's not a place. Dixon Hill, he's a hardball detective. He's someone that Picard's a big fan of and has decided to LARP as. He walks into Dixon's office, gets mocked for being in his Starfleet uniform, and marvels at the illusion of everything. This appears to be one of the first times he's been in a holodeck. A dame called Jessica Bradley is in his office. She looks lit like femme fatale, but has a terrible message. Someone's trying to kill her. He'll think about taking the job. She kisses him and says he'll take it. He leaves, but the program's still running, so a Peter Lorre type shows up trying to find him. Picard is thrilled by all of this, loves the holodeck, he won't shut up about it during the team meeting with the bridge crew. He suggests Crusher joins him, and he also wants to bring along their historian/fiction expert, Whelan. Data and LaForge talk about Dixon Hill, and Data downloads all the stories, which are apparently written by Tracy Torme. Hey, he wrote this episode! Picard and Whelan are about to enter the holodeck when Data joins them. Crusher, however, is running late. Now everyone's all impressed by the holographic street scene. They keep touching things. And Dixon gets a paper from Corman regular Dick Miller. And it says, "Wealthy socialite murdered. Oops. I guess maybe he should have taken that job a bit faster. Oh well." A pair of cops want to take him in because she died with his business card on her person. Which is enough evidence. To be honest, for some cops, especially in a noir, that may be too much evidence. A Haradan probe scans the Enterprise and it seems to futz with the computer systems, including the holodeck. Crusher finally enters through the doors and they're acting kind of weird. She meets Data and Whelan, who are still both touching things excitedly. Picard is being interrogated and Crusher gets upset that she doesn't get to play in that scene. Picard, on the other hand, is enjoying himself and really bad at getting in character. LaForge shows up to collect Picard and take him to speak to the Haradans as they won't speak to Riker. Understandable sometimes, but still, yeah, the holodeck, it does not respond. Crusher notices the other women in the police station and starts to doll herself up accordingly, only to then get ham-handedly hit on by the desk sergeant. Riker and Wesley go to the holodeck, as if they'd be somehow any better than LaForge at looking at it. And Riker decides best leave Wesley there to help out. You know, he knows a little bit about engineering kind of stuff. Dixon Hill is cut loose and Whelan is still touching things. Picard sees Crusher and she wears film noir very well. He's too polite to make like a cartoon wolf, but it's probably for the best anyway, because Data and Whelan are hanging around like really awkward fifth wheels to all of this. The Peter Lorre type is still in the office, and when they all show up, he draws a gun on them. While they're laughing about this, he shoots Whelan in the gut. Uh-oh, this is a real bit of violence going on. Whelan's actually dying now. Apparently there's some kind of idol which his boss, Cyrus Redblock, is after. They don't just come out and say a Maltese Falcon, which is brave of them. Picard gives a Peter Lorre type a dry slap and sends him packing. On the ship, they're running out of time, and in the holodeck, Cyrus shows up with the Peter Lorre type, as does Dixon's friend, who's instantly captured by Cyrus's men. Whelan is in a really bad shape. Picard tries to strike a deal with Cyrus, ditching kayfabe, mentioning, we're on a ship, there are riches on there. Wesley tries shutting things off and mentions people inside could vanish. Can a holodeck do that? Is that a thing that can happen? Doesn't matter, he does it anyway. The people are blasted with a snowy wasteland for a moment, and then they're back and the door opens. The Peter Lorre type and Cyrus Redblock step out and fade away, fully aware of their physical destruction. The problem solved, Picard heads up to the bridge saying his special lines and the Haradans are impressed. He tells Data off for still talking like a gangster, but tells the rest of the bridge crew to step on it. Like a hypocrite.
Charlie.
Yo.
This might be it. You did it.
I did it.
You did it in the full 5 minutes.
Oh my word.
I don't think this has ever happened. Charlie, I'm going to do for you what the crew of the bridge crew did for Picard at the end of the episode.
Wow.
Well done, sir. Take a bow. Take a bow.
Thank you.
Now, do you want to thank the Academy and Jesus?
No, it's all me.
Okay, no, all right. Oh.
Yeah, fuck those guys. So,
Charlie, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think you would look better in? A proper, cool, film noir Humphrey Bogart style fedora? Or a very natty bowler hat like Lawrence Tierney is sporting in this episode?
Oh, no. See, my heart says Detective Fedora, but my large frame says comedic bowler hat.
Your egg-shaped head
suggests...
Hey, Hercule Poirot has an egg-shaped head, and he did all right.
Okay.
You just need to work on those moustaches.
I know. There are so many iterations of Hercule Poirot. All of them have far better facial hair than me. I'm very jealous of them.
Yeah, I did. I was watching this episode with Rihanna. So I was like, okay, be honest. What do you think I would look better in? And she also said bowler, which I would find perfectly acceptable if I was dressing as John Seed from the Avengers.
Yes. Maybe that's it. Maybe we just need to reclaim the bowler hat.
I think we do.
You know, go, oh, no, it's not just a weird, slightly funny, antiquated thing. So in this universe, like private detective fiction author Tracy Torme, not writer of Star Trek Next Generation Season 1 Episode 12, Big Goodbye Tracy Torme, wrote all of these kind of stories. And did he ever get sued for plagiarism? Because, like, there's so much that is very obviously taken from other kind of film noir things. Is this just what happens with holodeck programs now?
Possibly.
Maltese Falcon and all that have just been lost to time. You know, it's the knockoffs that happened 200 years later that are the only pop culture they know.
You see, so at the same time, you know, given like the huge prevalence of hard-boiled pulp detectives, of like the Black Mask magazine variety, like your Dashiell Hammetts, your Raymond Chandlers, it's like, you know, you're gonna get your C or D list tier knockoffs who are basically gonna redo the same story with the numbers filed off. How many bad fantasy novels have you read which have basically been either like Tolkien or Jordan or Martin with like the letters slightly subtly filed away?
I mean, I used to read D&D novels so a lot, enough that put me off of high fantasy books for a long time. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the thing, though. Maybe Picard's a hipster. Maybe he's going, everyone and his neighbor has a Black Dahlia, an LA Confidential, anything like that. Me, I've got Dixon Hill. Have you heard of him? No. No, you have not, have you? No, yeah,
me when I'm talking about Elric.
Yeah, wow. Speaking of which, keep an ear out for Breakfast in the Ruins. Guest appearance from Miles soon. But yes, also, I think I've found a job that normally in Starfleet, it's like, oh my God, they're really good at science. I've never been great at science. They're really good at physical things. And I'm a chunky ogre. They've got a fiction specialist. I mean, I can't imagine they get much work Enterprise. But
if they're exploring strange new worlds and new civilizations, then you've got to have the guy whose job it is to catalog like alien culture and, you know, from their fiction. Because, you know, if you're gonna understand a culture, there's gonna be a part where, you know, you kind of have to understand how their fiction works. I mean, It's like in Macross, the Japanese anime, where it's a, you know, Western bastardization of Robotech, where the evil Zentradi are defeated not by like a huge, they're mostly defeated by a giant space fleet in a space battle, but the big thing that turns the tide is 80s J-pop and awakening them to culture.
So just in case that kind of thing happens, or in case, I don't know, fairy tales become real or something, you need someone like Whelan, who I guess survives. Like, they drag him away, so they probably still have their fiction specialist.
I was surprised that he did actually make it. I thought he was dead. I thought he was going to be dead meat for sure.
Well, yeah, because I'm pretty sure we don't see him again. So
no.
You may as well be dead at that point.
Perhaps Picard keeps saying, hey, you want to do Dixon Hill, and like Whelan's like, fuck off.
Yeah, I'm not speaking to you ever again. I know you're the captain. I'll just glare from a different table in 10 forward. The other thing is, like, watching this and realizing this is halfway through season one and holodecks. Like, are they new technology in the Federation here?
I don't know, because, it just seems kind of like that early, you know, that you ever heard of the trope early installment weirdness?
Yeah.
I think there's definitely some for that, because, like, by the time we get to, like, later on in TNG, and Deep Space Nine, especially, and Voyager, holodecks seem to be, like, the main way people enjoy their time.
Yeah, a way people keep saying when they're on a ship floating through the void for ages, especially if they're not out on the ground unless it's a mission. Yeah, I mean, I know obviously they couldn't have predicted shows like Discovery would have holograms, being like communication, but even those, in a way, like, here's a projection, not here's a room, which is, you know, you are in reboot, basically.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So yeah, it just felt a bit odd.
I think they had like a whole, they had like something like the whole deck in an episode of the animated series. I remember that happening, but just like, because they have it in the pilot, they have the holodeck in Encounter at Farpoint, because that's where Riker meets Data.
Yeah.
So,
although that's just hanging out by a stream, it's not really doing
reenacting.
Yeah. Odd. So, I did something, Miles. I found there are nerds out there who are a bit more than casual about Star Trek. And someone has transcribed the entirety of this episode. And the reason I went to do that is because the very specific things that are said to the Haradans by Picard are quite special. And the sort of thing that I couldn't quite just go back and replay and jot down. I needed someone to have transcribed them. So I thought we could test out our version of this. Now, it's been a week or so since I've seen the episode, so I can't remember the exact cadence of it all. So I'll be going off the cuff here. But I figure, frankly, looking at the words, it's not going to make a huge amount of difference.
Well, thankfully, I'm Welsh on my mother's side, so I should be fine.
Oh, good. Okay, so, do you want to try this first, or shall I?
Egg-shaped head before beauty. You go first.
Wow. So, this is Jean-Luc Picard, captain of the USS Enterprise. Ah, klaxon, lees, splag, blam, ah, nick. Candic, ah, Crassula, Trasula.
Okay, all I gotta say is I'm glad that you're editing this episode.
Thank you.
Alright, okay, I'm gonna give this a try. Mm-hmm. This is Jean-Luc Picard, captain of the USS Enterprise. Ah, Klaxon. Lees Black Blan Nick Kranik Ad Crassula Ras Tras Trasula.
Nice. So what do you think it means?
I think did you ever see the 80s Transformers the movie?
Yes.
Where they have the universal greeting, which is basically the words bar weep, grana weep, ninny bong.
Oh my god, I'd forgotten about that.
Yep, and
oh
so
god.
I remember a parody comic which translates bar weep, grana weep, ninny bong to spare my life, you may have the boy. Because it's said by Cup. While he's with the young Judd Nelson voice Hot Rod. So given Wesley Crusher, I'm also assuming that Picard is saying, spare my life, you may have the boy.
Perfect. Yeah.
Yep. So are you a fan of film noir, or just noir fiction in general, or just...
So a bit. Like, I'm not a massive noir head. I like it. I enjoy it whenever I encounter it, and I should read and watch more noir than I have, basically. I love LA Confidential. I did a whole module on noir at my media studies A level, where we covered, you know, Maltese Falcon, Chinatown, a lot of classics. And of course, I've written a comic called Blob Detective, which is a noir story about a detective who is a blob with no real ability to speak or fine motor skills. And yet, he saves the day, and he also fucks a mannequin golem mostly made of legs. Also a torso, but mostly legs.
your creative endeavors always strike me as truly terrifying and almost Lovecraftian in its ability to induce madness.
I had a moment where I was beginning to wonder, am I going to tank my comics career before it's even started? Oh, well. Oh, I'll submit this anyway. And yeah, you've met Matt. He enjoyed it. Yes.
Yeah. Man, I did.
You a noir person?
I do like my Raymond Chandler. I've read a little bit of Dashiell Hammett. I've read Red Harvest, which is most famously adapted into Yojimbo and A Fistful of Dollars. I'm definitely more in the kind of Raymond Chandler where it's relatively grounded and it's more about just the inherent corruption in Los Angeles and one relatively decent man's attempts to deal with this shit and stay like moral. But yeah, like it's clear, you know, they clearly shot this like a Paramount backlot. And God, thanks to the HD remaster, all the kind of noir sets looked fantastic.
Oh God, yes. Yeah, it looked very nice. Especially for a season one episode where you kind of almost give them credit that they're not going to look good. They're not going to afford the money or effort at this point.
See, I think that's like like I said, it's clearly probably shot on like a studio backlot. So you've got the location. They probably have a bunch of cars in like a store in storage. You get your extras. There you go. Looks fantastic.
Yeah.
Back to the Enterprise. Looks kind of cheap, but I do kind
like
of enjoy
that whole. Yeah, like that whole last act in the is in the office.
Yeah,
like, that's the main thing I remembered from it before watching. I was like, oh, there's a police station set. There's a street set. I forgot about these. In my mind's eye, it was just that one set goes awry. So yeah, it was good fun.
I love the one bit. There's two bits I kind of love about this. One is the bit of comedy where Data gets the light
to go over
and take it over, then unplugs it. He shakes the light while Picard behind him is just kind of getting and is just plugging the light in, and just Data kind of smiles when the light comes on and says, "Ah, I fixed it."
Yes,
I'm not sure if that's like something, you know. It kind of always feels like a moment that was just kind of worked out in filming, and it just looked like a nice little bit of, you know, like it's a nice little bit of physical comedy which isn't incredibly telegraphed as Star Trek comedies want to do, and. Then there's just like this very nice season, the season one is still them getting their vibe. So it feels a lot more earnest than a lot of TNG kind of gets. So it's kind of nice to have these bits where Troy and Picard are going over the translations and Picard is just really just kind of frustrated and tired and he's not just being stoic about it. And then there's just Picard gushing about the holodeck at the meeting for a moment when I thought he just had got the meeting together just so he can go, yeah, and I went to a holodeck and it was really cool and there was a girl there and we totally made out.
that's very nice. We were hoping to talk about fluctuations in the warp core, but yes, I guess we're doing your thing now, Picard. So we've had a good time, but ultimately, this must, as every episode that crosses our door does, go on to our big list. And that's a list going all the way from number one, which is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, down to number 93 with Strange New Worlds' Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach. Yes, we are still on our road to 100 things ranked here. Exciting. Apart from when it actually means we need to watch Threshold, which will be our 100th thing. So I'm looking at this and I'm looking at spot number 25, which is TNG's Elementary Dear Data. Slightly further on in time, this is a season 2 episode, and it's Data and LaForge doing Sherlock Holmes. And while I prefer like noir trappings and such to Sherlockian trappings, I feel it's probably a bit better quality wise.
Yeah, I think it the Elementary Dear Data does more interesting stuff with the holodeck. While this establishes the holodeck, it also basically goes, this is how 90% of holodeck episodes are really going to turn out from now on.
Yeah, like even the comparisons between Cyrus Redblock and Moriarty.
Hmm.
You know, as Moriarty's a lot more fun, given he becomes self-aware and aware of the holodeck, compared to Redblock, who's just kind of, is a way out to possible riches and stuff. And is it disturbing that they can actually make it out of the holodeck a few feet?
Yeah. Like, given that in Voyager, you have the Doctor who is unable at all to leave the sick bay, it feels like, okay. Again, it just kind of goes into that very much early installment.
Yeah, yeah.
Strangeness.
Is it like because you will feel yourself being unspooled as you get away from the projectors or something with the Doctor? Like, let's just tell him he can't make it past the door to save his sanity.
Then he'll leave us alone.
Yes.
We could walk if the Doctor gets too much, we can go away. And he cannot follow.
That must have been a sad day when he got the portable emitter.
He became more insufferable.
Yeah. Personally, I think Elementary Dear Data probably pips this just a bit, quality-wise.
Yeah, and I do think it plays more with, like, with Sherlockian cliches.
Yes. Yeah. Below that, of course, we've got Crossover, where Odo fucking explodes, which, again, I think it's probably better than this. I see. Is there anything just skimming down that strikes as, you know, worth kind of, not as good as this? There's the giant Spock, which is good fun, but it is just a giant Spock.
A giant Spock. So, is this better or worse than Giant Spock?
Giant Spock's fun in that kind of bonkers Silver Age Legion of Superheroes way.
Yeah.
I guess it's fun, but ultimately this gives us the rules of the holodeck. It gives us Dixon Hill for the first time. And, you know, we get some fun from each of the characters involved. You know, even Whelan, for what little he appears, is a good laugh.
Whelan immediately goes into trying to be the tank of the party.
Yeah, yeah. When they're all just laughing at the Peter Lorre guy and like, oh, he's threatening us with a gun. So, oh, no.
I love the part where Crusher is just excited about the idea of Picard being interrogated and wants to join in.
Yeah, whatever side's fine. Okay, so, yeah, I think possibly just above Infinite Vulcan, given, you know, Giant Spock's great, but it's probably, you know, this is probably a bit more of an important Star Trek.
When that goes in at number 33, under Meld, which a quick detour back to David Lynch's Dune. David Lynch's Dune also has that incredibly most moist of actors, Brad the Man Dourif.
Oh, wonderful.
With the most intense, with like the most incredible eyebrows, which of course, you know, goes against his role as incredibly moist screamer Wormtongue, where quite famously he shaved his eyebrows off to appear more unsettling.
Yeah, didn't I read somewhere that they hadn't asked for that?
Brad Dourif just looks like that kind of actor who's just like, I made a choice.
Yeah, yeah. Hey guys, I did this. So, oh. You know those guys have to grow back in at some point, right?
But at the same time, like, he nails it. It's moist Brad Dourif.
Gotta love that.
I can't remember his eyebrow action in Mel, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was the eyes, the contacts he had made him look particularly alien in that one. Right, so that's one more on the board. Next up, we have Star Trek Prodigy, Season 1, Episode 6, titled Kobayashi. Just in case you thought Prodigy was a kind of CGI cartoon that wasn't related to Star Trek, here they go, giving us a very classic Trek kind of name. And this one aired on the 6th of January, 22. It was written by Aaron J. Waltke. And directed by Alan Wynne. The UK number one hit was... So, for both of these, we're taking some psychic damage. First of all, there's Ed Sheeran and Elton John with Merry Christmas in the UK. And the US had Mariah Carey with All I Want for Christmas Is You. Holdovers from it being a festive season, but Jesus, our nemesis right there. I mean, Elton John caught in the crossfire, admittedly, but
yeah,
you know, like, no. No shirt to all no. Of that.
No. Like, I don't know. I think the moment in the song where Sheeran basically went, yeah, I know we've had a kind of a shit year, but next year might be better. And I was just like, oh, really, Ed? Is that because of your masses of money?
Probably.
Your masses of Ed Sheeran money.
Mm. Also,
your 30 pieces of silver.
Wow. Also, you mentioned there's another track that we should speak about here as well, because of a surprise music drop, because we don't get those often in Star Trek, you know, unless it's something diegetic. Yeah, there tends not to be stuff like this. So yes, and that's AC/DC's Thunderstruck, which it's one of those things. I'm not a massive AC/DC person. But it's a good song. It's a fun song.
It's a good song. I watched this with Rihanna because
we've
been watching Prodigy together because it's now on Netflix. And we made it through the first half of the first season. And she recognized it was AC/DC before I did.
I mostly know it from the early days of having the Rock Band video games.
Ah.
There were a couple of DLC packs which were standalone games, but you'd get a code in the back of a manual which would unlock all of those tracks in the main game. And I was acquiring a lot of music, especially because I was less conversant in a lot of the music that was there and was just curious. I was never able to get the Green Day one, but to be honest, that's fine. I had enough Green Day on it. AC/DC, there wasn't any previously, and it was like, I don't know, like £4 or something. So I just downloaded the code, got rid of the actual standalone game, and my brother put on a track for me to sing along to at a Rock Band party. So I used to have fairly regular, like once, twice a year, parties of getting people round. We'd drink a lot, we'd play Rock Band. And normally it's singer's choice, because that's the one where you can seem the most of an arse if it goes wrong. And yeah. I did shockingly well at Thunderstruck.
Oh.
I had not heard it before. I did not know how it was going to go. I've never dared go back to it because I can't imagine I'd do as well.
No.
And I may have been drunk for that moment, but it was a fun time. So yeah, I've always got a soft spot in my heart for Thunderstruck from that.
I appreciate AC/DC. Mm-hmm. I recently watched Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive.
Oh my god, yes!
Which is a so much fun film. I think that might be like I watched it with Rihanna, and we weren't anticipating how much fun we were gonna have. Especially the part where the child gets run over by the lawnmower, we had to rewind and rewatch that because we're like, whoa!
Wow.
Yeah, okay, so it's my turn.
Yeah, your Kobayashi Maru starts now.
The protostar has escaped from the diviner, and they had themselves a little bit of downtime. Gwyn is recovering from injuries sustained in the last episode, and Dal comes in to check on her, and Gwyn's like, oh, thank you for coming to save me. And Dal's like, actually, Hollow Janeway insists we go back for you. You can come out whenever you're ready, to Gwyn's disappointment. Meanwhile, the rest of the crew, apart from Dal, want to go to the Federation and claim refugee status. Dal's like, no, we have a good thing going. Let's just go on. Let's just keep having wacky space adventures in deep space with the ship we nicked. And everything will be fine. Mine's the final word. I am the captain. To which everyone reminds him, you declared yourself captain. We never actually had a conversation about this. Meanwhile, Rock Talk is worried because lovable big blob that eats everything, Murph, has gone missing. They find Murph in the holodeck. And Hollow Janeway introduces them to what the holodeck can do, be it skydiving on SETI Alpha 5 or Jane Eyre novels. Jank and Pog and Dal find a training program called the Kobayashi Maru. Wonder what that is. And Jane was like, oh, this is an advanced leadership training. You should be good. And Dal's immediately like, no, I am playing the mission. I am doing this. And it beams him onto a copy of the bridge of the Enterprise D and gives him a selection of crew members to choose from. Dal asks for the best and the brightest, and it gives him some of Starfleet's best and brightest, and also Odo, who, given that he's not actually Starfleet, I'm surprised he's here.
Yeah.
In universe, I mean. Dal goes for the Kobayashi and fails. He fails. Every time he tries something, he fails. The other crew members are Beverly Crusher, Uhura, and Spock. That will be important for later. Jank and Pog is just enjoying just ribbing Dal about his continual failures. Dal is now reacting like I do when it comes to being killed by the same monster over and over in Elden Ring. That I'm pissed. And I want to do this as pure matter of pride more than anything else. Jank and Pog leaves, leaving Dal alone. Meanwhile, Murph eats a bunch of proton grenades and the crew discovers that he's pretty much indestructible. At the same time, Gwyn is helping Hollow Janeway decode like some missing files in Hollow Janeway's memory to find out where this ship came from.
Oh.
No.
And we've hit time. Kobayashi Maru failed. Let's start the stopwatch. Go.
Dal has a plan, which he definitely thinks will actually work this time, swear to God, which involves him and Spock beaming onto one of the Klingon ships and commandeering it. They get the ship, and Dal's like, okay, we can relax, leans back, and accidentally destroys the Enterprise with some photon torpedo bolts from the ship. Dal breaks down. Everything he thought he did everything right, but if he can't lead a crew of holograms, how can he be expected to captain a crew? And Hollow Spock tells Dal, you know, being a captain is not about thinking about yourself. It's actually about the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few. And Dal realizes that what being a good captain is, what being a good leader is that he should put what the crew want over what he wants. And he comes to terms with that and asks how he could have won the Kobayashi Maru. The computer goes, actually, there's no way you can win. It's unbeatable. And Dal's like, I could have done it. And he leaves to join the crew who have now unlocked Janeway's memories. And Jank and Pog let slip that actually it was Dal who insisted that they go back for Gwyn. Aww. And they discover a holographic image of the Protostar's previous captain, Chakotay. What happened to Chakotay? Hollow Janeway has no idea. And AC/DC plays out during Dal's successful attempt at a Kobayashi Maru.
Wow. So that's 1 minute and 44 seconds. Yeah, so I don't know if it was just me, but seeing the holograms of the crew members, it felt like they remembered each previous run. Like there'd been a persistent memory there, because they seemed increasingly exasperated with Dal.
Well, Odo's already exasperated from Dal 2 minutes
by
in.
Everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe? Like, it seems like it. Or just like the more increasing ludicrousness of Dal's ideas, which I think culminates into they hide behind the bridge console and just wait for the Klingons to leave.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Yes, they, I liked the kind of hero of the kids show Star Trek thing for kids didn't instantly ace this thing that has stressed out so many people before. That it was that thing of learning that, yeah, this is an unwinnable thing and you need to rely on your crew. I found the voices a bit weird. They use archive footage as multiple actors here have now passed on. And not consistent voices. It's not... The background noise is different for different clips.
I think the one it's most noticeable for is Spock, because they're taking from so much different audio clips of Leonard Nimoy.
When he looks like his younger Spock as well. Like, still Leonard Nimoy Spock, but a younger Spock, despite the audio including a lot of old Spock, you know? And again, like, the mixing for some of those voice samples sound slightly more muffled or slightly less. And when I first heard one of the archived voices, I think it was Uhura who spoke first. I was like, are all of them going to sound that way to cover for taking a clip like that? But no.
I didn't mind it so much.
Mm.
You know, it's, you know, you could probably like spend a lot to kind of just clean up some of those audio clips, or you could just like let it go and just go, yeah, it's archive footage. We're not archive audio. We're not going to cover, you know, we know, you will know, you know, the audience at home knows what it is. We know what it is. Yeah. Why waste time and money?
I know. It just, I don't know. I found it a little jarring. And then they actually had, they had Gates McFadden doing Crusher. So she's the only one referring to any kind of key names or phrases or things. Maybe they could have messed with her audio levels for a little bit.
Yeah.
Here and there and go, okay, no, make it sound like that's, she's also like that. That would be good.
Just splice in from, just splice in some audio from like the Sexy Ghost episode.
Yeah, exactly. Around Dal. You know, he is a child.
I do love how Odo's first response is to quit in moral protest.
Yeah, that's very Odo. I assume Starfleet Records just pretty much claim him as their own and have him on the database. Like, sorry, Odo, you signed a consent form when you were, you know, first signed up here. Yes, you can have hologram representation.
This is why Starfleet wants him to do daily logs, is so they can basically AI clip him.
Yeah. You got to be careful of that sort of thing.
So, okay, I know, like, I've gotten the feeling that Dal's not your favorite character in Prodigy, because he's not Jason Manzoukas.
Yeah, so he's not Chad Kumpog, basically.
He's not giving us Maximum Derek, and he does kind of fall victim to kind of, you know, I think the same problem that Ezra from Star Wars Rebels has in his early season, in which he's the audience surrogate, and he's basically a little bit of a cocky shit who needs some very severe hard knocks.
Yeah, yeah. That's very much it. Like, I think I've only made it 8 episodes in through Rebels. So, yeah, Ezra was very much in that, you know. Again, yeah, that kind of, yeah, you can't tell me what to do, pups, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I'd wear a backward baseball cap if there were space ones of those. Yeah. Yeah. Thou is irritating. Like, he's not the worst of those.
No.
That I've seen. And after seeing, I think, now 4 episodes of Prodigy and playing, well, subjecting Emma to about maybe an hour and a half of the video game on the Switch, I believe I will never get her to go back to it.
No.
No, it is not a good game.
I will say, from having watched the first half of the show, is that I do think that the lessons Dal learns here, for the most part, sticks, because in like the next few episodes, you do see him grow up a little. You do see him take things seriously, adopt like being a leader, and also making moral decisions.
Yeah,
a lot stronger than he does beforehand.
I liked that it was similar to Boimler trying to speed run and do the Borg scenario really well. And I've definitely been there in trying to go, no, I will complete this, and getting worse. Like you were saying with Elden Ring, doing that with Bloodborne was what made me ultimately bail on it. Or playing Pandemic with my brother and my dad while getting increasingly drunk, lowering the difficulty and still going, no, we must beat this, and we are literally only getting worse. We are more drunk, we're more tired, it's 3 in the morning. And my dad's like, no, we're not leaving until we beat this damn disease.
I love the part with where he's like, he's tired of it, and he's basically, every time they're hearing a distress call from the Kobayashi Maru, like, nope, cut, skip, nope. Skip. Where's the skip? Where is the skip button on? Because like, I've had this on so many boss fights.
Yeah.
Or it's just like, I need to skip this goddamn cutscene. I don't need to go through this one character from Jedi Survivor's backstory. I just want to get to throw my lightsaber at this bastard.
And, yeah, I guess with that, shall we throw this bastard onto the list?
Sure. Like, man, what is our highest Prodigy?
Let's see, we've only got a few. I should really enable filters on this at some point to better see that kind of thing. We have, I'm scrolling.
This is the third episode we've covered.
Yeah, it was the two-parter. Thingy.
Lost and Found and Let's See from Borg Lie.
Yeah. Wow, so yeah, the highest we've got is 76 out of now 94. Wow, okay.
That feels kind of bad, because like, Prodigy is a fun, like, Prodigy is a fun show, but it's the same problem we have with Discovery, in which it's so heavily, even though it's a 25-minute kids cartoon, it is very heavily serialized.
Yeah, now, I mean, looking at that, Let Sleeping Borg Lie, is this better than that? You know, that's got some nice horror, and I admit I'm always a fan of horror, and when a kid's property can do that, that is always quite admirable. But you do get some nice classic moments, like this is a rare sight, seeing the animated versions of the Bridge Crew that are kind of selected at random.
They are. It is kind of like this. I can see why they went for distinctly non-human characters in the show, because their Spock looks kind of weird.
Yeah,
he does have he has a very pointy face.
Mm.
But I do like it. I like there. You know, like there's some good humor, which leads to good drama. And you know what? Even if it is slapped together from like a lot of like 50 years of archive footage, it is nice kind of to get one more meaningful Spock soliloquy out of Leonard Nimoy, even though I don't want that to be the norm in proper Trek.
Yes.
Because 100%. that's a slippery AI slope.
Yeah, I've much more enjoyed when Star Trek recasts or anything like that compared to the modern Star Wars is doing Uncanny Valley CG versions of people. You know, there's always something just slightly unpleasant on the surface there.
Well, with this, since it's inherently already a holographic simulation, it feels like a lot more palatable because it's not actually Spock. It's the computer communicating to Dal through Spock.
Yeah. So I'm looking not too far ahead, to be honest, from here. In spot number 69, we have A Fistful of Datas, some holodeck shenanigans, which, you know, was a lot of fun. There's Charlie X as well. We've got some iconic but not necessarily great original series just above here.
I'm surprised that Coda beats out on Cat's Paw.
Yeah. That's the way the list goes sometimes, I guess.
Part of me wants to kind of like put this close to Virtuoso at number 65, because that's the Doctor versus AI art, and there's a lot of that kind of thing here.
So I mean, we've got that. Do you reckon this is better or worse than Virtuoso?
Oh, I think I like some of the plot beats of this one more than Virtuoso. But at the same time, Virtuoso gives us a peak Picardo at the Doctor's most just snotty and insufferable. And that's always fun to watch. That's always value for money.
True. Below that, we've got Time and Again, another Voyager episode where Paris and Janeway go back to a doomed world and have to figure out whether they can save it or not, which I found surprisingly good fun for a very early Voyager. I expected it to be a bit rougher there. At the same time, like, it's good, but there's a lot of fairly standard alien world conflict kind of things there.
Alien world, Burger King uniforms, you know, the whole
it's the usual. Yeah.
So is this better than Coda, where Janeway has an evil dad, evil ghost dad?
So I like Coda. I like a lot of Coda. I felt it didn't entirely land for me. You know, it's why it's down here, despite a lot of the fun concepts. You know, so yeah, maybe this goes between Time and Again and Coda.
Yeah, I would have to agree.
Cool. So that puts it at 67. Cool. So our third episode of the evening, our grand finale, is from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Season 4, Episode 10, titled Our Man Bashir. It aired on the 27th of November, 1995, with a teleplay
I think you're saying it wrong. I don't think it's Our Man Bashir, but Our Man Bashir.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe.
So, the teleplay was by Ron Moore, the story by Bob Gillen, and directed by Winrich Kolbe. The UK number one hit was Robson and Jerome with I Believe, which fucking hell, that got everywhere. Like, Robson and Jerome, fine, I guess, but for some reason, they were all over the place at this point.
It's like,
it's music your nan might like.
Yeah, like, the problem is, like, when you think Robson and Jerome, it's just like, what, were Ant and Dec not there yet?
Like, Robson and Jerome, they definitely were, I'm trying to think of a guy, not Gareth Gates, but the other one. Like, not Ant and Dec, but you had the people, the boy band looking guys that would try and do the crooning kind of things. Yeah. Will something or other.
Will not that Will Smith.
No. Originally, I was thinking, Will, which Will? Will Self? No, that'd be a very different performance. Will Young.
There we go. There we go.
Yeah, although I kind of want to hear The Long and Winding Road by Will Self. Anyway, yes, there's that from the UK, and the US had another Whitney Houston song with Exhale, the Shoop Shoop song. I don't know why I was thinking, oh, Shoop Shoop, that's going to be something a bit kind of entertainingly lively. It wasn't really. It was nothing like thinking it was. I was thinking of that Cher one the other week.
Ah.
Yeah.
No, that was Cher Cher. Not Shoop Shoop.
Yeah. Again, like that thing of, for me at least, before Britpop hit in earnest and a lot of kind of other music from the mid late 90s kind of growing, a lot of what came before from the 70s and the 80s, you've got some classics and then you've got this level of thing, which people must have liked back then.
Yeah.
Because these are their number ones, but. Anyway.
Okay. You know, with Whitney Houston, I get it, but, you know, Robertson and Jerome, I'm sure, like, most of our listeners are going, what the fuck are they talking about?
Who are these people? Yeah. One of them was it Bronn? In Game of Thrones, the mercenary guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, feeling like weird, obscure, like British ephemera, which, you know, I wish was number one on an episode we watch, is like the Wombles.
Mm.
Because I just want to, I just love trying to explain the Wombles to Americans. Or Grange Hill, or Biker Grove, or Anton Deck. I need something new. I had to explain Britpop last week to co-workers.
Oh no. Wow.
Because I was around for that period of music, basically.
Yeah. That said, you mentioned Biker Grove and it's just unlocked something in my mind. No. There's a Kickstarter currently on, because we're in February at the moment, and Zine Quest is a thing where people do little RPG things. Someone has made a horror RPG drawing on all manner of weird folk kind of horror things and Biker Grove. And I was like, oh no. there we go. That is for horror.
Does PJ get blinded by a Lovecraftian menace that tears his eyes out and not a paintball accident? Maybe. All right. So I suppose we've got to go on with this. So, okay.
So, Armand Bashir.
Armand Bashir, which you're narrating, but hang on a second. Let me get into appropriate character one more time.
Uh-oh.
Good evening, Mr. Effridge Nunn. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to recap the Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode, Armand Bashir, in 5 minutes or less. If you manage to fail this and are caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. Good luck, Charlie.
Wow. Okay, so, smash! A goon with an eye patch goes through some glass, thrown through it by Julian Bashir, dressed up all Bond-like. He even quips after knocking the guy out with a champagne cork and kisses a random blonde. He gets very patronizingly applauded by Garak, who's very upset that Bashir hasn't been hanging out with him. Instead, he's been making time with his James Bond simulator. He's gloriously catty, especially when he sees the massive Kowloon apartment and Bashir's valet. Mona loves it. And, yeah, Garak's like, maybe I've been doing spying wrong. What a name. Back on DS9, or near DS9, Sisko, Kira, Worf, Dax, and O'Brien are all on their way back to the station after having done something very important that evidently didn't need Bashir. Their shuttle's been sabotaged and they beam off as it explodes and they're gone? Weird. O'Brien's understudy, Michael Eddington, has their rapidly deteriorating signals in the pattern buffer and needs to put them somewhere. He jettisons all of the station's memory to put them there and all the lights go off. And it seems to have worked. The holosuite, however, is still going on. And in Kowloon, Bashir's bar rotates. And there's a woman there in a revealing dress and an incredibly bad fake Russian accent. And it's Kira. That's weird. She's playing Colonel Anastasia Kamananova. Bashir thinks Kira came along to mock him, which is fair. But it's evident this isn't actually normal Kira. Something's up here. Odo calls and he recognizes Kira even with a terrible accent. That is actual Kira. She and the others are stuck there in the program somehow, and Bashir and Garak need to keep the program going while Eddington figures things out. Sadly, he's no O'Brien, so it may take some time. Kamananov has an assignment she wishes to share with British intelligence. There's artificial earthquakes going on and a missing geologist called Dr. Honeybear. It's Dax. They can't sit back and let the program tick over. After all, she might die, and I guess, you know, the world might as well. So, speaking of death, the door opens, and Mona Lovesit's dead body falls in. O'Brien's there. He's playing the part of Falcon, the goon from earlier, with a weird Falcon-patterned eye patch. There's some great classic spy action fighting, and Bashir insists they shouldn't kill Falcon, because that's still O'Brien in there. And it does look like the safety's off, because, of course, the safety's off. On Deep Space Nine, Rom shows Eddington and Odo the holosuite circuits, which are a mess. There's, like, spatulas and stuff fixing things up because of how cheap Quark is. They find the missing crewmen's bodies are in the holosuite, but their minds are everywhere else. So, in the holosuite, there's a party with go-go dancers. Bashir, Garak, and Kamananov bluff their way in to see Dr. Noah and meet Worf, who thinks he's a man called Duchamp. They gamble with him and get enough money to see Dr. Noah and end up gassed into unconsciousness for their trouble. Odo has meanwhile found the sabotages by someone called The True Way, but that's less important. That's a future episode's problem. Instead, Eddington's planning on beaming everyone out using the holosuite to talk to the Defiance transporters and reckons it should work. It'll just take a little time. Elsewhere, Bashir and friends wake up in a large room. Garak has some more notes for Bashir on spy life, but it'll have to wait as Dr. Hippocrates Noah has arrived. Of course, it's Sisko, and he's brought all the ham to this performance. He is having a real fun time here. He tests Bashir's geology knowledge with a gaudy vase, which apparently shows that they're in a mountaintop facility in Tibet. Kamananov asks, is Dr. Noah an anarchist? And he says, pretty much the opposite. Oh no. He's planning to make a new world by lasering the current one open, unleashing molten lava, shrinking the landmass of the Earth, flooding everywhere. His home will be a new island, and he has the finest minds there to repopulate the world. He also knows that this is Bashir, so all of that faking was for nothing. He also has Falcon here, who wants to say some words, mostly through violence. Bashir and Garak?
You have failed.
You are now
in Mission Impossible terms. You are now disavowed. You gotta get Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg, and then you have to climb the large Khalifa building in Dubai. That's how Mission Impossible movies go, right?
Yeah, something like that. As long as Tom Cruise gets to do some stunts, they'll write a film around it, and yeah, they'll climb for Wiz Khalifa. It'll be fine.
I just want to say before I start the timer, I applaud your fortitude to not mention that Mona loves it. Basically, falls dead into the room, boobs first.
Well, I mean, there's little more to her character than the boobs, ultimately.
All right, stopwatch going.
Go. Okay, so Bashir and Garak are taken underground and tied to one of the giant lasers. Kamananov was apparently quite spirited, so Dr. Noah will see that she helps to repopulate the world. He leaves after, you know, usual monologue stuff. Garak is a touch peeved at all of this. He doesn't want to die due to holographic magma just because Bashir won't end the program and murder all his friends. Bashir sees Dr. Honeybear in full science nerd mode. He suggests maybe take those glasses off. Maybe let that hair down. You see, Dr. Noah only wants her for her brain. But Bashir, he likes her for her body. Yeah, this seems to work. The pair kiss, and Honeybear gives him the keys to his and Garak's cuffs. The laser starts firing into the earth as Bashir and Garak flee. They dodge cave-ins as they go, and when Bashir pulls out the teeny tiniest gun, that's it, that's enough. I don't know why, but that's the last straw for Garak. He's going to quit. He's had enough. This is a mockery of his former profession. He can't stand any of this, and he knows that Bashir doesn't have the stones to make any hard calls. Well, Bashir proves him wrong. Shoots him in the neck. Not even like in some kind of less important part. He shoots him literally in the neck. Luckily, just wings him. But fucking hell. This proves he's got the stones to complete the mission. Fine, Garak's back on board. The pair burst in on Dr. Noah and the other DS9 staff who are conveniently all here. Eddington calls and says, hey, Bashir, you need to vamp for time for like 2 minutes, maybe? And he lets Dr. Noah monologue, which you'd think would last that long, but alas, doesn't quite. When Noah looks like he's going to try and kill Bashir, he decides to pull a twist and sides with Dr. Noah, causing some insane giggling. Bashir even presses the big button that floods the world. You know the one. Noah is pleased with this, but still ultimately wants to kill him because, you know, I've been doing this dance for a while now and he really needs to follow through. But at that moment, the transfer's complete. Sisko and the other crew members that have been trapped in here can be beamed away along with the others. Their minds and bodies are reunited. All is well. Back in the holosuite, Garrett's got to admit he was impressed with Bashir's plan, that he's willing to destroy a whole world just to go through with the mission, and likes this occasional escape into fantasy, so he'll play along with these games again. Bashir says, Julian Bashir, secret agent, will return, just like you see in the end credits of every James Bond film. But after MGM had a bit of a moan about this, no, he won't. The end.
3 minutes and 5 seconds.
Oh man, this was a fun one.
I know on this podcast I have mentioned my distaste for James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
See, the thing is that doesn't include like, you know, the cool plots. I'm down. Like, yep. The action sequences, down. Fabulous locales, down. The attractive women, down, down, down. The awesome music, with the exception of Die Another Day by Madonna, mostly down.
Yeah.
I just can't stand James Bond, the character, at all. Which is always kind of annoying, because everyone kind of assumes I love James Bond because British.
So, how do you feel about Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
I know I've seen some Man from U.N.C.L.E. as a kid, but it's always been one I mean to get back, I mean to check out, but just never have the time. And I don't think it's on like a freebie service, unlike The Avengers,
of course.
Danger Man, starring Patrick McGowan, The Prisoner, which everyone should watch.
Yep. Because, yeah, there's definite vibes of that here as well, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when Garak's initially dressed up, him and Bashir do have a very Man from U.N.C.L.E. kind of vibe to them. And, you know, Bashir's generally fairly easily outwitted, which also works for Napoleon Solo as well. But, yeah, this was a real joy to watch. I like Bashir, generally in incompetent mode. And here, he just wants to play his game. And it's all gone wrong. It's all gone wrong from Garak coming and criticizing it. And you can feel that shame. That kind of, you know, like if a parent came in and caught you watching an 18 movie, I imagine, given mine showed me Alien at like age 8 or so, I was never quite privy to that. So I guess slightly more me watching Quantum Leap at 11 at night, or watching Dawson's Creek with my brother in the building. kind of thing.
So do you think that Garak just either actually just made himself a very nice tux just to piss off Bashir?
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely. Garak did look good in that tux, though.
He did. I kind of like sometimes when you get the very, you know, you're quite used to like the alien species in Star Trek, and then you see them in, you know, a tux, or like Worf in a bright white suit acting as croupier.
Yep.
Yeah, it was all of those kind of really daft James Bondy kind of tropes, but getting to see all of the cast playing with it, you know, Odo aside, you know, they all got to have a bit of fun, be a bit daft. There wasn't much Dax, but yeah, like Sisko was amazing.
So who do you think is having more fun? Avery Brooks clearly enjoying going all ham to basically play Blofeld, or Nana Visitor, outrageous Russian accent?
Oh, that's difficult. I don't know. Like, I think Avery Brooks is great. Like, he's having fun, but he's generally so much more of a serious actor. I imagine this was a nice break for him, while Nana Visitor getting to put on a ludicrous accent. Like, I've seen her in varied sci-fi films and TV shows. Like, this kind of thing where you can just go full ham with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it felt like she was having some very good time. Looking at the kind of any of the extra notes on this or anything like that, it sounds like all of the actors had a whale of a time.
I mean, good. It's really fun. It's it plays all the tropes. I like the very kind of James, the kind of John Barry style score. Especially when they bring in the DS9 theme, but kind of just give it some trumpets to kind of give it like a 1960s Bond feel.
Yeah, I'm a lot less aware or pay a lot less attention to the music than you do. You're generally quite good at catching these things. But yeah, even I was like, oh, they've James Bonded the theme tune. That's nice. That was fun. Yeah, also, I didn't realise, timing-wise, this was timed to air when GoldenEye was released. Which, again, I could see that might be why MGM...
This kind of happened like this. This kind of, because, you know, to go back to Reboot, which we briefly touched upon, they did a Bond parody episode in their third season, Firewall, which goes actually one step beyond DS9 by replacing the usual Reboot opening credits with a James Bond style opening. With a song, with flames, with sexy women. That was what this episode was missing, was like... But then Star Trek never does, like, the... this era of Star Trek never does anything fun with the opening credits.
No. Like, they change up the DS9 titles, what, once? Maybe twice, but not... Yeah, there's nothing kind of wacky like that. But,
yeah,
you know, that's a very minor grievance to an otherwise delightful episode. And yeah, seeing Rom and all of the terrible things he's had to do to keep that holosuite going, because Quark will not pay for anything.
But also, like, this is Rom, genius savant.
Yes.
Which I know we definitely see later when he gets out from Quark's shadow. Okay, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Given that I think in a season's time, we find out that Bashir is actually genetically enhanced.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was one of those things they had planned, or it's kind of a retcon. Do you prefer the idea that that Bashir could make that shot in Garak's neck because he's just that good genetically? Or, like, Bashir actually pulled off something awesome because he's you know, a skilled doctor, and just made the shot.
So, like, I like Bashir. I'm generally an idiot Bashir truther, really. You know, I fully support, fine, yes, he could be genetically fantastic, but that doesn't stop you being a bit of a doofus.
No.
You know? Any of the kind of, oh yes, well, I was faking being rubbish. No. No. Like, there are some things that I'm sure, yeah, you were downplaying, but for this kind of thing, yeah, well, obviously you could go, yes, a genetically superior thing could graze a light amount of skin off air. I think it was a lucky shot that he didn't just fucking, like,
yeah,
ventilate Garak.
I think it really plays much more into, like, I think, like, the big theme of the episode is Garak's just anger at Bashir treating his profession as a game. And he's continually berating Bashir throughout the episode of going, you're just treating this as a game. And not that sometimes you have to make hard, difficult choices and that you might have to let someone die. For Bashir to turn around and go, I am willing to kill someone to win.
And it's just, you.
It's you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was a fun bit of reversal. Because, yeah, I can totally see Garak. Like, if this was a Lucari spy simulator, he'd be more down.
If we're in a John le Carré holosuite, we would not be in the mountain base, up a mountain with lasers. It would be Garak catching Julian Bashir, furiously masturbating and crying into, like, an expenses report. Because that's generally as much action as the le Carré spy novel, especially like the Smileys series, generally gets.
True, yeah. Dear, oh dear. Yes. So, anyway, on that note, and that said, as a separate tangent that we had on Messenger recently, there was the talk of the holosuites and how they're a very different experience from the holodeck. And I just feel very sorry for Rom having to mop up anything, any and everything in there.
I think this is why they unionize.
Yeah, yeah. That amongst other things.
Yeah.
Yes, so we ought to put this on the list. So I'm scrolling the fuck up.
Yup. Okay. Oh, hell. Do you think this is a top 20 or top 30?
Top 20? I definitely think top 20. It's... Yeah, like... The big negative to it is that they don't... It never comes back. It doesn't really establish anything to make it, like, iconic Star Trek. But fucking hell, it's good fun.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It shows you, like... I think... I don't know if this is the actual reason. I get the feeling that they really play up the holodeck in the 80s and 90s.
Mm.
So, you know, like classic Trek, they're always trying to save on money, and that's where we get gangster planets, that's where we get Roman planets, that's where we get Nazi planets.
Yeah, what have you got a set for?
Yeah. So definitely, I feel like, you know, let's do a Bond, you know, like, we do that, it's like, hey, it's so we don't have a gangster planet again, like, we'll just dick around in the holosuite.
Yeah.
And I just felt like this was, you know, like, hey, let's just do a, like, Bond's in the zeitgeist right now because of GoldenEye, best N64 game, one of the best N64 games, but let's just do a Bond episode, because why not?
Hmm.
Let's just have fun.
Okay, so looking at fun episodes, there's Subspace Rhapsody from Strange New Worlds for some musical fun, which again casts our main characters in a fun new light.
Yeah. Oh, let's see. Okay. This is hard because it really comes down to personal preference. Like, do you like musicals more? Do you like spy films? And like. I love Subspace Rhapsody.
Yeah.
But like, this is delightful. Like I think it gets all the jokes about Bond that Austin Powers is going to do in a couple of years.
Yeah. But it can also be played relatively straight. I think if there's one thing that this beats Subspace Rhapsody about, this one can be seen completely on its own, Subspace Rhapsody is very good, but you kind of need to know an amount of drama that's going on.
I think like the biggest thing you need to know about this episode is really Garrick.
Yeah.
You know, who he is, his backstory,
but even
his history.
That, they deal with enough to let it go, to pass, you know?
So I might have to agree, like, because it's fun to hold drink down.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, it doesn't have K-pop Klingons.
True.
But what does?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they'd have to be, like, go-go dancer Klingons or something.
Yeah.
To fit the era. Yeah, no one needs that.
I would definitely put this ass above Subspace Rhapsody.
Okay. Right, looking a little further, actually, we've got another DS9 of Necessary Evil where Odo does a noir, which I realised we didn't talk about at all in comparison to the Dixon Hill one, but
they
both feel quite different, really.
I think Necessary Evil, I would actually file more as neo-noir than just like traditional noir, because I feel it's dealing with weightier topics while using the same kind of framework.
Well, same way North Star was like that with Westerns compared to Fistful of Data's kind of frivolous fun. Okay.
I do, but like it's difficult because I think Necessary Evil is one of my favorite DS9 episodes. And that's unfortunate because it's right above my favorite TOS episode, The Conscience of the King.
Speaking of which, is this better than Conscience of the King?
Oh, God damn it. I hate you.
Yeah. I know what my answer is here, but, you know.
Oh, God. You see, The Conscience of the King doesn't have a character called Mona Loves It.
Although it was 60s Star Trek, so it could have.
It could have done. And I feel that both stories hinge down to, like, the main character of the show having to make an incredibly hard decision. And as much as I love seeing the very ruthless-driven Kirk, it's also really great to see Bashir, who is a doofus, who really wants to have all this be kind of be boy's own schoolyard japes and very kind of pip-pip and hip-hip hurrah. I just love the moment where he just turns around and just goes, Garrick, I will fucking blow you away.
Yeah, that's a fun moment. Okay. So, like, these are both very good episodes that are being weighed up here. So, we're talking about putting that at the new number 15.
Yep.
On the list. Okay. Well, there we go. And next episode will be our 97th through 99th episodes ranked on the list on our road to 100.
In case you've forgotten, for our 100th episode, we are devoting an entire episode to Threshold.
Yeah.
Hopefully we've not bitten off more than we can chew.
Hopefully. We'll see. Like, you saw what we were like with Tuvix.
Yeah, but at least with Tuvix, we had two other episodes to go around it.
Here, it's like,
can we make an entire episode of Threshold?
We'll
find out.
Yeah. But before then, our next episode is going to be our shameless, vaguely synergistic episode to the trailer of Star Trek Discovery Season 5, because it didn't tell us as much as Picard did. And frankly, we got a lot of things wrong with the Picard trailer. So we're going to be doing some treasure hunting and archaeology. We're going to be going off to Risa, the fuck planet. And we're going to see some shady Romulan technology. Stick around for that. And you can find us on Ko-fi, where if you donate any amount of money and have a suggestion of an episode for us to cover, or a theme or a vague idea, then will do that for money, basically. And we have someone who generously did donate, but their very special episode will be happening after Threshold. So, yeah, they can look forward to that. You can find us on Blue Sky and on the Nerd and Tie forums as Casual Trek. Miles, where can people find you?
You can find me on my my blog at mareedlobato.wordpress.com and mareedlobato.bluesky. And Charlie, where can they find you?
So I'm Skyshark at Blue Sky. I'm Skyshark on Itch, where my comic and role-playing game supplements can be found. And yeah, I've got a blog, Faked Tales, which I have not been keeping up to date, but hopefully will soon. Yeah, so that's, yeah.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, yeah, that's where I can be found. And yeah, good. Now we just have to push the big button and see which of us was a holodeck projection all along.
Hang on a second. I'm going to try and do my best Sean Connery. Now, Miss Moneypenny, I want you to go into a Starfleet and live long and have a jelly baby.
You've been listening to Casual Trek by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed-Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Casual Trek's part of the Nerd and Tie Network. And if you want to support us monetarily, because you love what we do that much, you can now do that by going to Ko-fi and looking up Casual Trek. There's a link in the show notes.